Well, I'd like to turn you this evening not to Judges 18, but to Judges 21. And the very last verse of the whole book, which is verse 25. Judges 21 and verse 25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. Now, you might wonder why I've turned you to the book of Judges on a beautiful, sunny Sunday evening, because it does make some depressing reading. It was a very futile time in the history of God's people. They were in the land that God had promised them. The Exodus was behind them. They should have been great days, but somehow they just couldn't possess it. They just couldn't gain the stability that God had promised them. And you get this great cycle of boom and bust that's really the story of the whole book. And as you read it, you sort of feel, well, what's happened to all those great promises? It feels a very long way from the Exodus and the great promises that God had made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and indeed the promises in the times of Moses. You feel a very long way from the book of Deuteronomy and its great promises. Well, the reason for this boom and bust and the reason for this instability is that God's people had not yet learned a very important lesson. And the lesson is, well, it keeps recurring in the book of Judges, but this very last verse captures it and summarizes it. What they hadn't learned was that they were God's people together, and that they belonged together, and that they needed to be together. And the cause, according to the book of Judges, for their boom and bust and for all of the instability and all of the vulnerability that they experienced, the reason why they hadn't entered in fully to all that God had promised, well, it's there. It was because in those days Israel had no king and everyone did as he saw fit. There was a tremendous individualism, everyone doing their own thing. And what we read there from Judges 18 is a case in point. People just going this way and that, doing their own thing, taking things into their own hands. Some of them with good motives, doing good things. Some of them with bad motives, doing bad things. But a free-for-all among God's people. Now, I raise all of that because I think this is one of the most important issues that we face. You know, we live in days when this is true again. Have you ever thought that our culture is the most individualistic culture in the world? The modern era, the last 400 years, is the most individualistic era in history. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if you hadn't noticed that, because it's so much part of the air that we breathe, we just think it's completely normal. But what we miss and what we don't notice is that it shapes us and it defines us. And even as Christians, this individualism is woven into our thinking. Now, the big lesson of Judges is that that is not the way it ought to be. And so what I wanted to do tonight was, well, with Judges there and thereabouts and in the background, but other passages as well, chew over that subject of individualism. And I just wanted to raise it, and you make of it what you will. There's a few things I want to say. Now, the first is a sort of general point. I want to show you that even as Christians, the individualism of our own day really does shape us. I'll give you a couple of examples. I'll throw them out and see if you see what I mean and see if you agree with me. For example, I would say that individualism shapes how we read the Bible. You read the New Testament. You read the New Testament letters and you find there a command, or you find there an instruction, and you find there the word you. Now, almost all of us instinctively would read that as you singular, you individual, you, Ian Parry. This is Paul writing, and it's an instruction to you, or it's God writing and it's instruction to you, Ian Parry, in your life, in your circumstances. And we read it as a singular to me. But have you ever realized or ever thought that actually that's not the case? English is a really inadequate language when it comes to talking about you. Because it only has one way to say you, whether it's talking about you individual or you crowd, you group, you community. It uses the word you. And you know, in the New Testament, most of the time you read the word you, it's not you as an individual, it's you group. You church, you community, it's plural. This was brought home to me a few years ago when we had a team over from the southern states of America to help us with a children's club. And they don't have this problem because in their particular dialect, southern, they say you when you mean you singular. But when they mean you plural, they say y'all. Now, I would like to revive that. I would like to bring that across, because I think we should have a southern translation of the Bible so that we could get the y'all in there. And we would understand and we would be astonished just how often what the Bible is saying, it's saying to us as a community of God's people, not just us as individuals. Now, what that means, of course, then, is that because of our culture, because we have these individualistic blinkers on, we're misreading the Bible. And actually, no wonder it's depressing sometimes to read the Bible, because we read these statements, you know, go and do this, go and do that, go and do the other, and you think, oh, here's me, I've got to go and do this, I've got to go and do that, I've got to go and do the other. And we sort of try and carry this, and we wonder why we sink into the ground. But what we forget is the Bible is not saying that to you as an individual. You've got to do these things. You carry this. He's saying it to us as a church and as churches. You're going to carry this. I'll leave that alone now. But you get my point. So I've got to go into the world, all the world, and preach the gospel. I can't do that. Yeah, but it's addressed to us as churches. Go into all the world. So I play a part in that. The Bible says, be the salt of the earth. I say, I can't be the salt of the earth. Well, it's spoken to us as churches. So as churches, we are to be the salt of the light of the world. Same thing applies. Do you see, our individualism shapes us as we read the scriptures, and it gives us a problem. Another example. Our individualism, it shapes the way we instruct new Christians. Now, if you become a Christian recently, I'm sure one of the first things that was said to you was, look, you need to have a quiet time. And every day there needs to be time when you get on your own and you read and you pray. That needs to happen. Now, don't panic. I'm in no way suggesting that that's a bad thing or an unnecessary thing at all. The personal walk, our personal individualistic walk with God, is foundational. The point I'm making is this, that our individual reading of the scriptures is not the main way that personal walk with God is sustained. That might be a controversial statement. But I heard Stuart Olliott preach this once, and he pointed this out, which I'd never thought of before. And what he said was this, that we have a Bible. We have a Bible in our home. We read the Bible as individuals. If you think historically, if you think globally even today, there are thousands and thousands and millions of Christians that haven't been able to do that, that can't do that, either because they can't read or because they haven't got a printed Bible. Printing was only invented 500 years ago, was it? And even then, Bibles and printing was incredibly expensive. It's really quite a recent phenomenon that anyone can afford to get a Bible and take it home. So if my personal individual reading of the Bible is the thing that is supposed to drive and sustain my entire Christian life, what has the world been doing? What has the church been doing for the first 1,500 years? You see the point? So what was he saying? What he was saying was this. The foundational way in which our spiritual lives are strengthened, the main way, although it's important that we read and pray as individuals, the main way that it happens is by coming together and hearing it preached and talking about it together. That's the way over the centuries whereby the church has strengthened and sustained our individual walks with God. It's because we've been able to come together and that there's been somebody who had a Bible and they could preach it and explain it and we could talk about it and we could take that away and we could chew it over and work it through and talk about it with others. You see, a corporate thing is the foundation. Now, maybe that's a controversial thing to say, but blame Stuart Olliott, not me. And have a chat to him. So there's another example. I'm throwing them out just to show how our individualism can shape the way we think about Christianity. One more. It shapes, actually, I think, the way we relate to church as a whole. I suppose it can come in different forms. Maybe I've certainly met people whose individualism makes them hostile to the whole idea of belonging to a church. I've met other people whose individualism makes them think of the church in a sort of consumerist way. So they come to a church as long as it's pushing their buttons and meeting their needs, but when it's not meeting their needs, or if they get tired of it and fancy a change, or if there's a special offer down the road in another church, they up sticks, they leave, and they go to that one. A sort of consumer way. They treat the church the same way as you treat Asda or Tesco. You know, you go to Asda, you quite like going to Asda, you feel at home in Asda, you like the stuff you can buy in Asda, the price is right. But if you find Tesco has got a better offer and every little helps, you're going to drop Asda and you're going to go to Tesco's and you're not going to think about it. And that's perfectly normal with supermarkets. In fact, if you've got a loyalty to Asda and you worry about Asda when you're not there and you're utterly committed to Asda, whatever the price, you've got a problem. But if you apply that to church, which is what people do, if you apply that to church, you've got a problem too. This is our individualism. It's all about me and you must meet my needs. And it's the meeting of my needs that is the heart of this. And if you're not meeting my needs, well, it's bye-bye. And it's go find somewhere else. It's our individualism that does that. Or maybe our individualism makes us committed to a church, but in an impersonal way. So we come, but we don't let anybody get close. That's our individualism that makes us do that. Or maybe we are committed and we are personal, but it's always one-way traffic. So we're always giving help but never receiving any, or we're always receiving help and never giving any. Okay, let's leave that. What I'm trying to just throw out there is some of the ways, without knowing it, perhaps, that our culture's individualism has shaped the Christianity that we're familiar with. And there have got to be tons of other examples. I just can't think of them. Right, that was the first thing then. It shapes us. Second thing, it doesn't just shape us, it holds us. It is extremely hard to shake off this sort of individualism. Very hard. Now, I'm interested in that. Why do I find it hard to commit to a group of people in a church and give and receive and be personal and be there, commit? Why is that so hard? Well, I suppose one answer is it's cutting against our culture, and that's quite a hard thing to do, isn't it? You've got to be quite countercultural to commit to a body of people like that. But I think we can go further. I think I'd want to argue that actually, this sort of individualism that our culture enshrines lies at the very heart of our fallenness, of our sin. You see it in Genesis 3, I think. Go back to Genesis 2, and there is Adam and Eve, first man, first woman, in the garden. There is a picture of marital bliss there. And when Adam sees the woman, his wife, well, there's the first poetry, isn't there? Here is bone of my bone, here is flesh of my flesh. You know, it's such a wonderful thing, he just has to burst out in poetry. So there's this wonderful picture, a man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh, and Adam is chuffed to bits with his wife. Then in Genesis 3, sin enters, and everything changes, doesn't it? Suddenly in Genesis 3, it's every man for himself. the woman you gave me, she tempted me and now I've sinned. Adam suddenly is separating himself off and he's out. Look, I'm going to make sure I'm in the clear. It's her fault. And actually it's your fault, God, because you gave her to me. You see the change. Suddenly, the sin that Adam has committed has made him into an individual. Suddenly now he's going to fight his corner. He's not going to back his wife anymore. He's not going to stand together with her. Suddenly he can dump on her. So he's going to dump on her. Put the blame on her and let her bear the brunt of it all. And so, well, hopefully God will punish her and I'll get off. Do you see? Everything's changed, isn't it? He's become an individual. He was an individual before in the right sense. But now he's become an individual in the wrong sense. A selfish individual. A proud individual. And actually, as you read Genesis 3 a bit more closely, and you listen to what the serpent says and how the serpent tempts Adam and Eve, you find that at the heart of that temptation is the promise that Adam could be like God. That's what he says to them. Look, if you eat of the fruit, then you shall be like God, knowing good and evil for yourself. And there's rebellion there, isn't there? But there's also individualism there. He's also saying, you don't have to be part of God's world and part of what he has made and conform to his patterns of community and marriage. You can break out of that. You could be God yourself. You could create your own little world and you could be master over your own little world. You could do that. And that's what he embraces, that sort of individualism. And I want to suggest to you that that's why individualism feels so right. It's why it just fits with who we are. Why? Well, because we are sinners. This is why, big statement, I won't make it, I will make it. This is why Western culture is so pervasive and so powerful. One of the reasons, anyway, it's got to be. Because it just flatters my fallen human nature. It runs with what my fallen human nature wants. It says to me, yes, you are a sovereign individual. You shall be like gods. What it says to us. It institutionalizes this aspect of our sin into the whole culture. And so it feels right. It matches our fallen heart. It fits our fallenness and it feeds our pride. So it's hard to break out of. It holds us. Because it's a function of our fallenness. Now the third thing I want to point out, and here we'll finally get back to Judges a little bit, is that this individualism doesn't just shape us, it doesn't just hold us, but it hinders us. It's a problem. Now obviously it's a problem, because if it's part of our sinfulness, it's a problem. The wrath of God, judgment, it's part of what God is judging in us, our sinfulness. But what I want to do is maybe zoom in and I'll pick up just three aspects of how this individualism can hinder us. And two of them are from the book of Judges and one of them is more generally from the New Testament, an observation. First way it hinders us is this, it brings about this instability. I already mentioned, didn't I, the book of Judges and the cyclical nature of it, you know, and God raises up a judge, a leader, and everyone follows the leader, they're united, and the leader accomplishes great victories, and as long as this leader, this judge is there, whether it's Gideon, Samson, whoever it is, as long as the leader is there, everything's fine. When the leader dies, pretty soon everything is back where it started, and everyone starts doing what is right in their own eyes, forsaking God, going after the idols, etc., etc. And time again, every one of the judges, as you go through, this same cycle is happening, boom and bust. Read about it in chapter 2, verses 18 and 19. That sort of described the cycle of boom and bust. When they had a judge, it was okay. When they didn't have a judge, they all went their own ways and everything collapsed. Now, we saw, didn't we, that at the very beginning I pointed this out. It's their individualism. Verse 25, the last verse, Judges 21, says, it's because they had no king and because everyone did as they saw fit that this boom and bust thing was happening. So, what am I drawing out from that? I'm saying that an individualism then, where we do what's right in our own eyes, it creates an instability in our lives. It creates an instability in our churches. Think about churches, and maybe this is a Welsh thing, but emphasizing the pastor. We're always looking for the great preacher who will arise and solve all the problems. Is that a Welsh thing? I don't know. It's certainly true. We do it with the rugby players as well. We're always looking for the next fly half who's going to beat the English every single time. We're always looking for it. And when they come, we laud them and we follow them, and they're on the telly and they're heroes. And there's a boom. But when they go or when they die, there's a bust. That can happen in churches, can't it? But it's not the biblical model. Pastors are significant. I know I would say that. But they have a significant role. They're ministering the word. You read Ephesians 4. And the significance of pastors is explained not because they do everything, but because they have a strategic role of ministering the word that enables the church and strengthens the church and equips the church for the work of ministry so that they can build one another up. Ephesians 4 is a vital passage to understand individualism and community and how those things fit together. But our individualism, it doesn't let us do that. We're not a body that builds itself up. We just look for a minister that will solve all our problems and put them all right. And I'm sure Paul will. But that's not the pattern that's here. You're the agent of change, the agent of growth in Ephesians 4 is not the expert, the pastor. It is the congregation, the people. The church builds itself up as each part does its work. Unless that's there, there's going to be an instability. You're going to be like Welsh rugby, which is not a happy place to be most of the time. Okay, so there's instability. That's the first thing. It can hinder us, this individualism. Then another thing that it will do, and here we're coming to Judges 18, it makes us vulnerable. Now, you remember the story in Judges 18. I read it to you. There's a bit there about Micah and his idols, which is in the middle, and it's not really where I always wanted to go, but I had to read it all, otherwise the story didn't make sense. But separate Micah and his idols and put those outside. The main thing in chapter 18 is the fact that the Danites are looking for somewhere to live, and so they send out the spies, and they spot the city of Laish. And they say, we're going to get Laish. Why do they single out Laish? Why do they think Laish is the place to go? Well, it was a very nice place. It was a very spacious place, a very prosperous place, a wonderful place to live. But that wasn't what it was. Verse 28 tells us that they went to attack the people of Laish because they were easy pickings. Because they didn't have relationships with anybody. Because they were a long, long way away from anybody else. Because they were isolated. And that's still true. Isolated Christians are vulnerable Christians. We are not meant to be alone. We need each other. There's a tremendous phenomenon in the New Testament, which you must have noticed. It's all those one another commands. You know, love one another, bear one another's burdens, encourage one another, build one another up, stir up one another to love and good works, be kind to one another, tender-hearted. Loads of them. In fact, 46 times across the New Testament letters, 46 times, there is an instruction that includes the one another thing. Now that's unprecedented, that degree of repetition, one another. And see, it's back to this plural thing, this assumption that the people that are reading the New Testament are not individuals on their own. They are part of a church, and they're meant to be part of a church. One another. Now what that means, of course, is this. You can't do Christianity on your own. Now, some Christians are in prison. Some Christians are isolated for other reasons. God will undertake for them. God will sustain his own. We are saved one at a time. There's no block booking in heaven. I'm not saying that. I'm not arguing that at all. But how can you obey those 46 one another commands on your own? I'd be impressed to know the answer. I'd be pleased to know the answer. You can't do it, can you? Because one another requires somebody else. In fact, one another, I think, requires more than one other person. You've got to have a community to do the one another thing. So there are 46 commands in the New Testament you cannot obey if you isolate yourself as a Christian. And that leads me to the third thing, which is an observation from these one another commands. If we then isolate ourselves, surely then we are massively weakened, because we are depriving ourselves from one of the things God has given us to strengthen us and to help us. But God has said in 1 Thessalonians 5:11, encourage one another and build one another up. Now, if then I am distancing myself from people, then I am isolating myself from one of the sources of encouragement that God has given to me, which is other people encouraging me and building me up. I'm losing that God-given source of encouragement, aren't I? I'm saying I'm not doing. How many times are we there praying, Lord, strengthen me, Lord, help me? And, well, God has given us one another to channel that help, to channel that encouragement. He can do it direct. Of course he can do it direct. He can do it while you're home. I pray he does do it while you're at home on your own, reading the Bible with nobody else. Of course he can. Let's look for that. Let's rejoice in that. Let's be glad about that. But let's not be blind to the fact that there are 46 one another commands. Do you see what I'm saying? And we could go on. How burdened are we? Often we are burdened. And if we detach ourselves from other people, then we are losing a God-given way to lighten those burdens. Because in Galatians 6 verse 2, it says, bear one another's burdens. And I could go on for the other 44 saying exactly the same thing. Let's not do that. You see what I mean? Do you understand? I'm saying if that person next to you is God's provision for your encouragement, for the bearing of your burdens, a source of kindness, a source of stimulus to stir one another up, and if you are pushing that person away, not engaging with that person in that level, you are shutting yourself up from that resource, from that source of help, a God-given source of encouragement that we need. I said this to our own congregation sometimes and to myself. If you are in a rut spiritually, then this is the first place to go. Have I isolated myself? Okay, that was the third thing. It's individualism, it hinders us. Now, the last thing. Is it the last thing? It's the last thing. Good news. The good news is we have everything we need to blow this individualism right out of our lives. It is strong, it is deep, it is embedded in our culture and therefore instinctive to us. It is at the heart of our sinfulness and therefore instinctive to us. But there's good news. So the good news is this. This individualism is one of the things that Jesus died to destroy. He died to destroy the works of the devil. John says that, 1 John. Well, individualism, that's one of the works of the devil, where we shut each other off, where we join Adam in Genesis 3, dumping blame on everybody else, trying to be like God, that's one of the works of the devil. Well, Christ came to destroy those works. What did Jesus say himself in Matthew 16? He says, I will build my church, group of people, body of people, community of people. That's what Jesus is doing. So when he died on the cross, he died not only to save an individual from hell and bring them to heaven, he also died to bring that individual into a new body of people, a new set of friends, a fellowship, a church. And he died so that that church could be strengthened and increased and become rich and full and be a support network and a witness corporately in a community, to be a model of another way to do it, another way to be human, another way to live your life. Ephesians 2, Paul tells us that Christ, when he died, he broke down everything that divides human beings. Jew and Gentile, divided by thousands of years of God-given laws, food laws, other laws. Ephesians 2 says that when Christ died, he removed that wall, he broke down that wall, so that out of the two, Jew and Gentile, he could make one new man. Together, a new humanity. Do you see, our lives as Christians are absolutely full of impossible things, aren't they? I'm forgiven, that's impossible. I'm a nicer person than I was before I was a Christian, that's impossible. I don't do things anymore that I used to do before I was a Christian. That's impossible to change like that. Can a leopard change its spots? Well, God has done that. Christ has done that. His death on the cross has done that. His Spirit in our lives has done that. Now, what I'm trying to say is that individualism can be one of those things that Christ deals with and Christ removes. And that's where Judges would take us. What causes that cycle of boom and bust? How does individualism flourish? Well, it's not just, according to verse 25, the last verse, Judges 21, it's not just because everyone did as he saw fit. It's also because in those days Israel had no king. Why does individualism flourish in the Christian church? It's because Jesus does not have his place in our lives. That's why, according to Judges, there is no king in Israel. Doesn't have his place. You see, if Jesus has his place in our lives, we do the one another thing. We can afford to do it because we don't have to be better than everybody else. We're already accepted. And we can afford to serve and care. And we can afford to do that because God is worrying about us. We can afford to worry about others. And we can do it because it's our delight, because we'd like to be a little bit like him. You know, we are never more like Jesus than when we are laying down our lives for others. So this problem, this individualism, it shapes us, it holds us, it hinders us, but it need not do any of that. Well, what I'm trying to say is, I'll end with this. Don't make your home in the book of Judges. Are you doing that? Are you making your home in the book of Judges? A world of individualism? A world where you're doing what you think you want to do? You will have your moments. There will be Gideon moments and Samson moments. You'll have some good days. But they won't last long. You'll be in that cycle of boom and bust in your Christian life. No, there is a king in Israel. And his name is Jesus. Put him in his place. Make your home in that New Testament world. A Savior who accepts you freely. A Savior who is building his church. That's a wonderful place to be, you know. The gates of hell will not prevail against that church. I don't know about you, but that's where I want to be. I want to spend my life in the book of Judges. I'm going to spend my life in that church against which the gates of hell cannot prevail.